listening to a download from the outdoorstation.co.uk. Number 416.
Hello and welcome back once again to the Outdoor Station, and this is the first of a two-part cycling-based podcast with Laura Bingham. As you'll hear, her adventure was slightly different to most in that she set herself the target of a 7,000-kilometre ride from the Pacific to the Atlantic. Yes, certainly a challenge. However, she chose to do it without spending any cash. Ah, now there's a real challenge. So keep listening to hear more behind her reasons and obviously her experience. You may already be aware of Laura's particular achievements from social media or perhaps other podcasts, and I've put a link to all of those, plus more to photographs, a YouTube channel, Instagram, Twitter, etc., all over on the show notes on the Outdoors Station website. Now, this interview perhaps takes a slightly different angle to the others as we look more at the practical and logistical aspects of this challenge, her relationships with those that joined her, as well as what's involved in recording a trip like this with a view to creating a television programme. As I mentioned last podcast, we're now also starting a monthly competition to win some great outdoor gear, so listen out for that during the show.
So my name's Laura Bingham, and my recent expedition was to cycle 7,000 kilometres across South America from Ecuador to Argentina with no money. So within those just over 5 months that it took me, I didn't spend a single penny on food or accommodation. I literally begged, found, and worked my way across South America, and it was hard, but it wasn't impossible.
Well, that's a nice introduction to your actual trip. Now, this took place, I believe, was it January or February you set out this year?
It was in January. I arrived in Ecuador the startish, well, mid-January, and I started the expedition at the end of January.
Okay, and then you got back in September, am I right in thinking that's when you got married?
I got married in September, yeah, but I managed to get back late June, so...
Okay.
I was away for about 6 months, but cycling for just over five.
Right, okay. Give people an idea of the reason you actually set this challenge out for yourself.
Well, in the year before, I was working in Mexico teaching English and doing jaguar conservation. And then I sailed back to England from actually Orlando because I had to get a flight up to there to catch the boat to go home. And when I got back, I wanted to find the next thing and do something a bit bigger and a bit crazier. So I decided to cycle across South America. But then I thought that, well, everyone cycles across South America. It's not that much different. So I was on the internet looking for inspiration, and I found this charity that takes in young girls that, you know, their families don't have enough money to look after them, or their parents are abusive and violent, and they're all there for a different, like a myriad of different reasons, but all there for a reason. So I wanted to try and raise money and awareness for this charity and also have a better understanding of the ordeal that they had to go through before they arrived there and what true hunger felt like and true desperation felt like, because a lot of people in England don't know what that feeling really feels like. And I still don't think I know 100% what it feels like, but I have a much better understanding now.
So I know your trip took in a visit to the charity. Did you actually visit them before you actually set out?
Phil, the founder, he's still here in England. So I visited him beforehand and he told me all about it, all about these girls and some stories that really inspired me to have an ongoing relationship with the charity. Like, he told me a story of these two girls that arrived there, that they arrived in the morning and they had breakfast and they went off and played and they were called in again for lunch. But when they were called in for lunch, they were so confused because they were so used to eating every other day when their father would come back from work that they physically didn't know, they didn't understand that they had to eat three times a day. And I just couldn't wrap my head around the fact that these two young girls that were 7 and 5 just didn't know that they had to eat three times a day. They thought they only had to eat once every other day. So I was quite blown away by that.
Yeah, it's certainly when you get involved with charities overseas, and over the years I've been involved with different ones, and you start to hear the stories of other people less fortunate than ourselves, you start to perhaps get a different perspective on things, and it brings it home, doesn't it?
It does, and it's quite difficult then coming home and speaking to your friends, and their biggest problem of today was that their nail just broke and they have to wait 4 hours to get to the nail salon. And you almost want to hit them to be like, no, that's not the biggest problem in the world. But you can't, because everyone's problem is relative to themselves. So I can't berate anyone for thinking their problem is the biggest problem in their world, because it is. And I found that quite difficult when I came back, to take these sort of trivial problems and give them the attention that that person needed, even though I knew that there were other bigger problems in the world.
The trip itself, if we can talk about sort of in different stages, really. First of all, our listeners are very practical people that do a lot of activities themselves and a lot of adventures. Maybe they do it sort of quietly, but they're not headline adventures, shall we say. So they'd be interested in talking about the practicalities of a trip like this, the planning and the actual function of it. And then we'll sort of perhaps touch on some of the stories and some of the emotional side of it, because I know there's a lot of different things that I've found, from seriously cyber stalking you and the background to this particular trip. And obviously there are numerous things which touch on different aspects that come out of a 7,000 mile cycle ride, which 7,000 kilometre cycle ride, which for people overseas is 4,337 miles. That's because I'm slightly OCD. So the actual trip itself then. Now, I understand you sort of came up with this idea for no particular reason. You were sitting in your bedroom one day and it came to you. Between the idea sort of appearing and actually a date being set, how much planning was involved?
See, I spent almost a year trying to plan it, but I tried to find a production company that would come on board, and I found one, but they were a bit of a sort of a cowboy production company. So they sort of ended up wasting about 6 months saying, you know, it needs to be an £800,000 production. We need this, we need that, you need to find sponsors. And for someone that doesn't particularly have a big name, doesn't, you know, no one really knows me, it's extremely hard trying to get any money out of companies. The best I did was get a couple of bikes and a bit of kit. So that was a completely unrealistic expectation. And then I ended up getting a different production crew. But I spent a lot of time trying to plan it and sort of getting nowhere and trying to follow all these guidelines that by sort of in the end, I just said, you know, F-U-C-K it, I'm just going to go. So I bought my ticket in November for the January the 6th. And then within those 2 months, I just got everything sorted. I, you know, bought the panniers. I just got all the things that I needed in the bag. So I think you can plan it as much or as little as you want to. I tend to not plan things very well or very thoroughly. I deal with all the sort of medical essentials, like getting malaria tablets or making sure I have stomach antibiotics just in case. And then a form of communication like a sat phone. And other than those sort of basic safety items, I don't think you really need that much. And I believe wholeheartedly that you'll figure it out. If you need to figure it out, you'll figure it out. And that's what I did. I planned my route before I went. And then whilst I was out there, I ended up doing a completely different route. So I needn't have planned the route in the first place. That was sort of a day wasted in planning, but it gave me sort of a good idea where I was going. I think you can plan as much or as little as you want to.
It sounds to me that you had two different tiers to the planning there. You had obviously the practicality about the route that you were going to take from the Pacific to the Atlantic. And then the second one being your ambition to obviously get a production company or get some sort of media production behind you. What drove you to do that, if you like, on your first expedition? Because I've found speaking to people that have developed a media career, as it were, it usually comes after they do the first one without media support. What was the push to get on board with a production company so soon?
Because when I was 18, I left college, and instead of going to university, I thought I'd do sort of a year traveling, which then turned into about 4 years of traveling. And I hopped from, you know, Greece to South Africa, Belgium, Indonesia, Florida and America, and then to Mexico, and doing a whole different myriad of jobs. And it was when I sailed back to England that I was 21 at the time, and I thought, okay, I've sort of run out of that window where I can just have fun and go traveling, and now I need to start thinking of a career. So I started looking through all the different things that I enjoyed, that I was good at, and the only thing that made sense to me was traveling and doing these types of adventures. So I made a very conscious choice to try and combine the thing that I loved the most with trying to make a career. And that's what I did. I tried to get a production crew on board to make a documentary and as much media coverage as possible so that then I could start building a career.
I know you approached your now husband, Ed Stafford, for advice on the actual trip itself as you were in the planning stage. I believe so anyway. Was he sort of supportive with doing this as a way forward, or was he trying to sort of hold you back, as it were, and just do one thing at a time?
No, he's been, he still is the most supportive, motivating person in my life. It's just really funny because I emailed him asking for advice, but from our first meeting, I was trying to ask him business questions and he was asking me how many children I wanted. I just remember being like having my little pack of all my questions and, you know, my route and all of my plans and stuff, and just thinking, no, that's not why I'm here. But by the end of the date, it was, we were quite inseparable. And then 3 months later, he asked me to marry him. But he's been so supportive and so motivating for me and my career choice and my dreams.
Back to the trip itself then. You obviously gathered all the equipment that you would need here. There's the equipment, obviously, that we were talking about from doing the trip itself, the bike and the panniers and the practical things. And then there's also the, as you pointed out earlier on, the satellite phone, the safety gear, the technology, the video cameras, whatever it was you took with you. So did you ship all those out in one lump sum and then sort of put it all together when you got there? Or did you send it out in stages and have a sort of like a staging post somewhere where you could collect it all at the other end?
I had my entire family at the airport. So there was about 20 of us literally packing the bags at the airport because that's how prepared I was, and taking the bikes apart and putting them in boxes. And unfortunately, we broke one of the bikes the morning before, that morning. So Ed spent the entire day whilst I was saying goodbye to my relatives, trying to fix the bike, buying a different part to fix it. So we arrived at the airport, put everything in the boxes. I had like one sister pushing one bike in a box, the other sister pushing the other bike in the box. And I had four big bags with the eight panniers in and all of the stuff. And I got on the flight, everything went through perfectly fine. And it was only when I got off the flight that I picked up all of the bikes and the bags off the carousel and looked at it and went, oh shit, am I going to carry all of this out of here? So I had to get like two trolleys and push them like simultaneously with like pushing one 6 foot, pushing the other one 6 foot, pushing the bike box 6 foot, pushing the other bike box 6 foot. And it took me forever to get out of the airport. But I did it in one foul swoop.
Good grief. Well, that's a story in itself. And did you have somebody there to meet you?
No. I've managed to try and got this like little mini bus that fitted about 15, 20 people and got it to drive me to the sort of hostel hotel that I was staying at.
Okay. And then did you spend a few days putting it all together, I presume?
Yes. Yeah. I started off with Cho, who walked the Amazon with my husband. And we spent about two or three days putting it all together, packing it all. And then we got out of the hotel and we couldn't ride the bikes. We physically couldn't ride the bikes. We had to push them to the bus stop. And then the bus wouldn't go. So then we had to get a taxi to a different bus stop and trying to find a taxi driver that would put that bike and the trailer and everything in it was impossible. And then we got to Quito. No, Quito was where we started. Then we got to Manta, which is the coast, so that then I could start, we could start from the beach. And then I had to spend a week in a hotel in Manta waiting for an electric part that I forgot. Ed had to send it to me from Argentina so that I could convert electricity from the solar panel to charge my laptop, because I had to take the footage from the camera and put it on the laptop to put it on a different hard drive.
Okay, so you were taking a fair amount of technology with you then. I mean, you're talking to somebody who's fairly experienced in a lot of the things you're talking about. So I'm just trying to visualise how much technology you took with you. And so by the sound of it, already we're into laptops, we're into solar panels, we're into, obviously, video cameras or cameras, mobile phones, sat phones.
We're into too much weight, basically.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, part of our interest is keeping things simple and reducing that weight down. So if people were to look at your pictures and on Twitter and Instagram and your website, all of which will be on the website, of course, and as well to the links to your YouTube channel, they'll see that you were fairly laden up with, I think, four or five panniers on your bike, plus towing a trailer, plus Cho. Now, I think it might be just worth clarifying to people, because the story can be understood in different ways. Although you chose to do this trip as a solo female, you actually had company in different stages going along purely from a safety point of view. Is that correct?
Yes. I had completely intended to do it on my own, the whole thing. But then when Ranulph Fiennes became a patron of the expedition, he said that to my husband that he thought he was being quite love blind to the risks. And he thought that I should have someone coming along with me. And when Ranulph Fiennes suggests something, you tend to listen. And so I had Cho go with me for the first 2 months, and then I went alone for about 2 weeks, but then I got attacked. So I got my fiance at the time, now husband, to cycle with me for a month, and then Ness Knight, another adventuress, for 2 weeks, then my sister for three, and my other sister for three.
Okay. We'll talk about the different stages of that particular range of people in a second. But the thing that I'm unclear on, so forgive me for asking the question, but when you look at the information that you've put out there, obviously you were going with the intention of not spending or not having any money, doing it completely money-free. The people that came with you, did they live to the same expectations as well? So they had no money with them either?
Yeah. That's I made them. But all of the females that came couldn't speak any Spanish. So it was completely down to me to get all of the food for them.
Right.
It was annoying.
Okay. Okay. Well, presume you had, obviously, just like you have to consider the different aspects from a safety point of view, you also had a safety fund, an emergency fund, that should you have an accident, which in actual fact you did have a couple of accidents, you did have some funds to call on for medical reasons.
We had a credit card, and I had a credit card with me just in case. And I actually had $300 wrapped up in about four in a plastic bag, and then about four tapes of four layers of duct tape, which I kept with my passport just in case needed an emergency lift somewhere. But I didn't use any of that.
Okay. And then I noticed looking at the map that's on your website, there's it looks like a spot system where it's just gives out a message saying I'm here and I'm safe. Was it a spot system, or was that based on the satellite phone you used?
No, that was a spot system. That was the most sort of efficient, easy way to get a message back. And it had the sort of SOS system on there too.
Okay. So there's quite a few boxes of technology there, isn't there?
Yeah. To give you an idea, my front right pannier was all electrics. And panniers are quite big, and that was a very heavy pannier. And then my front left pannier was all of my miscellaneous. So it was my first aid kit, my wash bag, my eating Tupperware, a cup. Actually, I didn't end up having a cup in the end. I threw that away. So all of the miscellaneous things. My back right was my tent, my sleeping bag, and my clothes. And then my back left was food, the food pannier.
And what was in the trailer?
I ditched that in the Amazon because I am such a relief it was. It was a giant first aid kit in mine, and loads of extra clothes and loads of just extra useless crap that I ended up giving pretty much all of it away to people that helped me, which was the intention, because it was sort of gifts to trade for when people did something nice when they didn't need to. I could give something in return. So I gave a lot of clothes away, and I just brought a much, much, much too big first aid kit with me when I left, and I ditched most of that.
Mm. It's amazing what you can get away with, actually, when you start realising how much your emotional weight you carry with you sometimes with the safety bag, isn't it?
It is, yeah. You feel like you need a huge first aid kit just in case. But I had like an IV kit in there. I had those the things that open up your throat. I did a medical course just before I went, a MIRA course, a medicine in remote areas course. And I literally had everything that a paramedic would need. Minus the oxygen tank.
Well, I'm sure you were glad to ditch that. Every month, we're holding a special competition where you can win some fabulous outdoor gear. It's a great way to support the Outdoor Station, as we receive a small percentage from every entry, and you have a chance to win a great prize. During the month of November, the prize is an Evinnu Titanium Non-Stick Twin Pan Set, consisting of a 1300 and a 900 milliliter titanium pan, with a combined weight of only 296 grams, valued at £135. Simply answer the following question and text in your A, B or C answer before the closing date of the 30th of November, and you will be automatically entered. You can enter a maximum of 5 times from the same mobile phone number. So, this month's question is, the new President of the United States is A, Donald Duck, B, Donald Trump, or C, Ronald McDonald?
To be in with a chance of winning, all you have to do is text OUTDOORS and your answer of A, B or C to 82055. Or post your answer with your name and contact phone number to Competition, The Outdoors Station, Unit 19 Signet Business Centre, Hanley Swan, Worcester, WR80EA. Entries are open to anyone aged 16 plus and you must have the bill payer's permission. Texts cost £1 plus your standard network rate, and the competition closes at the end of each month. Entries received after that date will not count, but you may still be charged. The winner will be contacted within 3 days of the competition closing, and they may appear in future programmes. For full rules plus terms and conditions, please go to theoutdoorstation.co.uk/competitions.
I know, again, I've looking at the research and the stories that you've told already, that Cho, who took part in Ed's trip down the Amazon, they were good partners and they worked well together. But I understood from a couple of things that you've said that he had a very sort of machismo attitude towards women, and you found that sort of fairly hard going. Was he sort of pushing you or sort of just giving you negative sort of feedback all the time? How did that work?
At one point, because I used to dabble in a bit of modelling beforehand, and one of the reasons that I decided to do this type of career is because I was told that I was just too fat. I wasn't pretty enough to be the size that I am, and I was just too fat. I had to lose 3 inches off everywhere. So I told that to Cho at one point, and at one point he turned around and said that he thought I should just go home and starve myself for 2 weeks because I'd be better at that, better at modelling than I was at cycling. And I was like, thanks. And he said, it's not my fault that I'm slower than him because I'm a girl and that's just the way it is, and he'll wait for me if he needs to, because it's not my fault that I'm a girl. And just things like that when you're already feeling very negative, very down, very emotional, you don't really want someone trying to be nice, but saying it's not your fault that you're a girl.
Yeah. It doesn't ring like sort of the supportive nature that you'd need when it's freezing cold, pouring with rain, you're starving, hungry, and somebody says, well, that sort of thing. It's not good team spirit.
No, it's not the most motivating. I know he probably meant it in a good way. He was trying to be helpful, but it was just a very clear example of that macho, male, doministic type relationship that just didn't work for me. And it worked for Ed perfectly fine because they were both male. Ed was older than Cho, so it was very easy for Cho to see Ed as the older leader in that expedition, whereas I was a younger female coming in, trying to sort of instruct. Not that I was really instructing, but it was my expedition, it was my trip. So I think he struggled with having a younger female leading him.
Exploring that a bit further, just to let people know, you were obviously 23 when you did this?
Yeah, still 23.
Okay.
I left when I was 22 and I had my 23rd birthday out there.
Okay. But for a lot of people, that age is, you know, can be seen, I suppose, in different cultures as being very, very vulnerable. And along with the advice that you had about the safety aspect, how did people react to you as you went through the different countries from as a point of being the age that you were doing the trip that you were doing?
Thankfully, I come off relatively mature, so I don't think my age had much to do with it. No one really, I never felt judged on my age. And very rarely felt judged on my sex either, just in the relationship with Cho. It was more of what countries were familiar with cycling. So in Ecuador, no one really understood why someone would want to do a cycling trip. It was sort of like, why aren't you just at home working? Why aren't you earning money? Why aren't you, you know, just being normal? Whereas in Argentina, there were so many cyclists that cyclists would just cycle past me in the day and then offer to take me home and have lunch or dinner at their house. And it was a much more, the Argentinian culture was much more understanding as to why I was doing what I was doing. So they were much more supportive rather than thinking that I was just completely bonkers.
There was one thing that really came to mind, really, reading the sort of the blog posts and some of the writings that you've done, is that it must have been confusing to people in the different countries and certainly different neighbourhoods, depending if it was a poor rural area or a sort of more affluent cities and towns, I guess, that here you were giving the perception of a wealthy Westerner and actually pleading poverty to do the trip. Were people confused?
A bit. I think because I was doing it for charity and trying to raise money for young girls, I think that made it slightly more understanding because there was a bit more of a reason as to why I was doing it. But I think a lot of countries did find it quite difficult having a white woman coming in and effectively begging or trying to work for food. I remember in one village, I don't think they'd ever seen a white person before, because we asked to stay in their sort of village hall, their casa comunal, and we went to this sort of communal house and we started making a fire and cooking, and the entire village came out and started watching us. And we had about 40 people crowded around us, just watching us, to the point that then I felt so awkward that we went back into the village hall and shut the doors, and I had to hide in the tent. I had to put up my tent and hide in the tent because everyone was staring through the windows watching me, and I felt so embarrassed. And I didn't really know what to do.
And did you talk to them in the morning about it? Were they, did they agree that this is the first time they'd seen white people?
No, not really. They all sort of slowly disappeared. And then we asked the next door neighbour if we could use her tank of water to wash in and stuff. And she was quite friendly. She was nice. But people were definitely staring a little bit. But after about 2 hours, they just sort of dispersed and went back to their houses and stuff.
The list of countries you went through, Ecuador, Peru, Bolivia, Paraguay and Uruguay. I heard you say at one stage that Ecuador was definitely the most anti-gringo, anti-white people. Was that true?
Well, I didn't end up in Uruguay. I ended up in Argentina, so almost right.
Okay.
But, so I went Ecuador, Peru, Bolivia, Paraguay, and then down through Argentina. Ecuador was definitely the hardest, and they were the least tourist-friendly nation that I crossed. But that was mainly in the Andes. The people on the coast were a bit friendlier, but the people in the Andes, they were much more wary of tourists, and they didn't particularly want them. A family did take me in for a few days, and I helped them on their farm clearing sort of woodland area. And I asked them, I said, you know, I don't think people up here particularly like tourists. And they said, no, we don't. We don't really want tourists here. We don't need them. They don't. And I said, you know, I thought everyone, every country needs tourism because it helps the economy and it helps the country. And they said, no, we don't need it here. We don't want anyone here. And I was like, oh, okay, well, thanks, bye.
So the cycling itself, I suppose you did a bit of that somewhere along the line. The videos I've seen, it all looks like pretty good highways, but then there's been a few where they're sort of fairly muddy tracks. Did you try and keep off the main roads and take a sort of a more challenging route, or was it literally the best route that you could find between A and B?
The best route I could find between A and B. The life out there was hard enough. I didn't need to make it harder with challenging roads. No, I definitely tried to find the shortest, nicest way. Some of the time I got it. A lot of the time I didn't. There were a lot of bad roads there. Unfortunately, my sister Claire and I, she got the worst lot of roads with me. In Bolivia, it was just about, we had a day of good roads and then it just went to really, really bumpy, 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 bumpy roads, the type that give you a headache after about half an hour. And we just couldn't build up any speed and it was just the most agonizing road. And then we tried going off-road a bit, but it was so sandy in places that our bike would just suddenly get stuck. It'd be hard sand for a while and we'd be like, yeah, picking up some speed, this is good. And suddenly it'd be loose sand and the bike would just stop and we'd just nearly fall off every other minute. And it was really infuriating. And then the roads just got really sandy that we ended up having to sort of drag the bikes through it for a bit. Unfortunately she got a really bad lot of roads.
The people that came out to support you, did they also ship out their bikes or did they pick a bike up while they were out there? It must have been fairly expensive if they shipped a bike out every time.
It was the same bike the whole way along. So Cho left in Lima and then when Ed arrived, he picked up the bike from Lima and then got a bus to Arequipa. And then when Ed left in La Paz in Bolivia, where he left, Ness joined me and picked up the same bike. And then we cycled to the Salar de Uyuni and she left. And then I waited there with both bikes for my other sister to arrive. And then my sister picked up that bike, cycled to Asuncion in Paraguay. And then she flew home and my sister Sarah then picked up the bike in like exactly the same place that my sister left it. And then we cycled to Buenos Aires together. So it was the same bike the whole way along.
So that was a little bit more additional items for you to carry along. So did you bring that bike back as well?
Yeah.
Good grief. Right.
Yep. That bike has been welded and bent back together. It's a real credit to that bike. I can't believe that it made it through. It got snapped in half.
Wow. Well, I've seen one of the video pictures of Ness explaining that there's some wobbly bits on it that shouldn't be there. In part two, we hear more about the rich and varied food Laura enjoyed and endured. We hear how different the emergency health service can be in South America. And we hear the real truth when asked if she would ever do it again. All the links to everything we've discussed are in the show notes, along with the charity details that she mentioned. If you feel inspired to make a donation, please follow the links there. Thanks, of course, to my guest Laura Bingham. Thanks to you for listening, and part two will be along very soon. Until then, bye for now.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To hear or see more from our extensive free library, please visit theoutdoorsstation.co.uk.